I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. It's the 12th day of the government shutdown affecting 800,000 federal workers. Some have been furloughed while others work without pay. They're the casualties, the pawns in a fight between President Trump and the Democrats over funding for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, something Trump promised as a candidate with Mexico footing the bill. The Democrats, who will control the House tomorrow with the start of the 116th Congress, have a plan to reopen the government by funding all departments except Homeland Security through September. DHS would be funded temporarily with no money for a wall. They want to force a vote by Senate Republicans and shift the blame for the shutdown to the GOP. Senate Leader McConnell said he would not send something to the president he would not sign. Well, back in December, President Trump meeting with congressional Democrats Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer took responsibility for the shutdown.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle of shutting down. And I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we believe you shouldn't shut it down.
There's a meeting this afternoon at the White House for congressional leaders for a briefing on the border. We asked Jonathan Bernstein to join us. He's Bloomberg opinion columnist covering politics and policy. Jonathan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Molly Reynolds. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where she studies Congress with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedure affects domestic policy outcomes. Molly Reynolds, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Molly, does this fight that has been ongoing for almost 2 weeks now, is that a preview of what's to come with Democrats in control of the House starting tomorrow?
So I think with Democrats in control of the House starting tomorrow, we'll see this actually turn into a little bit more of an uphill battle for President Trump. You know, Democrats now will have control of the House, and they intend to put something on the floor tomorrow afternoon that would reopen the government and really try to shift blame even more so to Republicans, both in Congress and the White House, for inaction and for the continued government shutdown. In terms of what it says about what we should expect to see during the rest of the new Congress that starts tomorrow,
right,
I think it is a solid preview of the kind of gridlock that we should expect to see on most issues. It's going to be very difficult for House Democrats and Senate Republicans to come together on much of anything, I think, over the next 2 years.
Jonathan, is this a losing battle for the president, this wall that he wants along the U.S.-Mexico border?
Well, it certainly seems to be. You know, polling says that the wall is unpopular. Trump himself is unpopular, which sort of feeds into that. He's made the decision to do this, even though he could have picked this fight at any point when he had unified control of Congress. So, you know, it's sort of difficult to analyze where he's going with it, since it's sort of irrational that he chose to do the fight now when he has, you know, less leverage in Congress than he used to have.
Well, and now there's a whole semantic debate about whether a wall is a fence or maybe it's shrubbery. I'm not sure if it's concrete planks, if it's a metaphor. Can you speak to that, Jonathan?
Well, you know, Trump changes his mind about it, you know, sometimes within the same tweet. So it's a little hard to figure out what his bottom line of what he would consider a victory would be. You know, sometimes it sounds like he needs a 30 or 60 or 120 feet wall, concrete wall, the length of the border, and then sometimes it's, you know, a see-through wall, and sometimes it's spikes, and sometimes he says, well, the wall's almost already done. You know, we've already, and it sounds like, well, fencing is fine, and of course there already is fencing across much of the border. So, you know, the part of the problem with Trump getting to any kind of resolution on it is that he doesn't seem to be able to make up his mind about what his bottom line is.
Let me play actually a montage we put together. Some of this came from MSNBC, but this is Donald Trump as a candidate and also as president talking about the wall.
Who's going to pay for the wall? Not even a doubt.
And I say Mexico's going to pay for it. And it's going to be paid for by Mexico. Believe me, 100%. 100%. We're not paying for it. Mexico's paying for it. I'm going to build a wall. It's going to be really a wall. It's not going to be a little wall. It's going to be a big, beautiful wall. And it's not a wall. It's a little fence.
That's 10 feet tall, and it's a fence.
I'm talking about a wall. See that ceiling up there? Higher.
See that ceiling? That ceiling is peanuts, folks, okay? But it's got to be a real wall, not a little toy wall.
Not a toy wall like we have right now.
Steel slats. We don't use the word wall necessarily. Steel slats.
We have a little bit of a shutdown because we believe in walls and we believe in borders and we believe in barriers.
I can't tell you when the government's going to be open. I can tell you it's not going to be open until we have a wall, a fence, whatever they'd like to call it. I'll call it whatever they want.
Molly, how do you negotiate with someone like that?
So that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, of President Trump as an actor in legislative politics, is that when he is all over the place on, you know, exactly what he means when he says he wants a wall at the southern border, it makes it really difficult for all of the parties involved to reach some kind of deal that gives each actor, person in the negotiations, the political cover that they need to make a deal and commit to it. It's really difficult to negotiate under those conditions. It's also really difficult to negotiate with someone who's so susceptible to changing his mind based on the last person who's had the president's ear. So, you know, the week before Christmas, we saw Vice President Pence go to the Senate and tell senators that if they passed a short-term spending bill that went through February, the president would sign it. And then within 2 days, the president had listened to conservative members of the House Freedom Caucus and had come out and said, no, I won't sign what the Senate has passed. And so those conditions make it really difficult for negotiators in Congress to reach a deal and stick to it.
Jonathan, a statement from both Pelosi and Schumer about this deal, I guess, that they're offering in the House. They said it would be the height of irresponsibility and political cynicism for Senate Republicans to now reject the same legislation they have already supported. So they are really putting the pressure on Schumer and others in the Republican Party in the Senate to either vote yay or nay, and I guess then accept responsibility for what happens.
Well, right. As Molly said, the Senate already voted for what the Democrats could accept before Trump changed his mind. And now Mitch McConnell says, well, we're not going to send the president anything he won't sign. But, you know, so it puts McConnell and Senate Republicans in this terrible position because the president undermined them. And, of course, you know, as the negotiations continue, they don't want to be stuck with that again. So they want to make sure that the president's on board and not doesn't undermine them a second time.
What do you think is going to happen at the briefing this afternoon, Jonathan?
Who knows? You know, I'm sure the president will have things to say. You know, as Molly said, it's just very hard when you can't take commitments of what the president says seriously.
Well, and he did say, and he has repeated, that Mexico is going to pay for the wall. Molly, Mexico is not going to directly pay for the wall.
Right. I mean, and the amount of money that it would take to build a significant new border barrier of some kind, even that amount of money isn't really what we're talking about here. That's a much larger number than what I think anyone in Congress at this point is really thinking is reasonable. So a lot of this argument, I think, is really about the politics of symbolism and about trying to get to a point where everyone involved can save a little bit of face. But again, it's really hard to figure out what that face-saving deal looks like when one of the key negotiators, the president, is all over the place on what he's asking for and what he says he's going to do.
Do you think, Jonathan, and again, I'm asking you to look into your crystal ball, if I can put it that way, but do you think that there, if there is some negotiating to be had with the wall and, let's say, DACA or some other immigration-related issues?
You know, I think that the safest ground right now that probably most people in Congress, including Republicans, would like to do is just sort of paper over. The real differences here within Congress are actually not very substantively very large at all. They're talking about, you know, the difference between maybe 1 billion, you know, 1.3 and 2 point something billion. Usually that's possible to paper over and find some words that, you know, make everybody happy. The problem is getting the president to agree to it.
Well, meanwhile, you've got DACA recipients whose fate is unclear. And you also, Molly, have something like 800,000 federal workers whose future is uncertain and is, in a sense, hangs in the balance. These are people that are not making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So they've got something in the bank. I mean, these are people that have mortgages and children's, you know, uniforms or whatever to buy.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think sometimes we overlook the human cost of government shutdowns. There are important kind of broader costs to the country and broader economic costs and what it means to be constantly trying to budget and plan under uncertainty. But for not just for the federal employees, but also for federal contractors, you know, the folks who do the janitorial work at the Smithsonian. Those kinds of folks are unlikely to see back pay. You know, federal employees generally get paid back when there's a shutdown, but contractors generally do not. And so there are hundreds of thousands of Americans who are looking at, you know, what the president and Congress have done here and are facing real economic hardship because of this one particular fight over the border wall.
Does anyone care?
I mean,
well, the people who need paychecks care.
Well, that I get. But I'm just saying people that, you know, control some of the levers of Congress. Quickly, Molly, and then I'll get to you, Jonathan. But I mean,
who
that's OK. Who cares?
So, I mean, I think members of Congress do care. I mean, I think the Democrats, you know, are when they have power in the House starting tomorrow, are planning on taking steps very quickly to try and reopen the government, try to force the Senate and the president's hands and put something in front of the Senate that looks like something the Senate has previously agreed to and try to get things moving again. But I think some members of Congress care. And I think that the longer the shutdown goes on, you know, we're coming out of the Christmas holiday now. I think we may see voters care more as well as things, as, you know, people's beyond just federal employees, as people's lives start to be affected by government services that aren't working.
Jonathan, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. And we are talking about the upcoming session of the U.S. Congress convenes tomorrow on Thursday. It's the 116th Congress. Talking with Molly Reynolds, fellow in governance studies at Brookings. She studies Congress with an emphasis on congressional rules and procedures. Also with us, Jonathan Bernstein, and he's a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and he covers politics and policy. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. What do you want your government to do? Radio Times at WHYY.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about the government shutdown and the battle over a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Also, we'll be talking about the 116th Congress that gets underway tomorrow and what's on the docket. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jonathan, any thoughts you want to add to what Molly said about just the fate of federal workers who are either furloughed or not working or not getting paid?
Well, one of the important things to remember about them is that, contrary to some of the Republican rhetoric that we heard early in the shutdown, you know, they're not all in Washington, Maryland, and Virginia. They're all over the country, and they all have senators and members of the House, and outside of the ones in Washington, D.C., of course.
Right.
And, you know, they're going to start contacting them. They're going to be very upset. And so are the people who go to national parks and find that the services are deteriorating and other people who need government services of various kinds. And, you know, it's easy for Republicans going into one of these things to think, you know, we're against government. Nobody will mind that the government shut down. But then it turns out that ordinary Republican rank-and-file voters actually use the government quite a bit. And when it's not there, they're going to contact their members of Congress and be very upset.
Jonathan, one of the things the president said was that the federal workers were Democrats. Is that true?
A lot of them are, but there's plenty who aren't. And there's plenty who, even if they're Democrats, they may be Democrats who don't get very politically involved. Of course, they can't. You know, there's rules about federal workers. But you know, the more that they get angry, their families get angry, their friends get angry, that's not something that Republicans want to happen. If they're angry, that is, at Donald Trump, the person who said he was going to take the blame for the shutdown. You know, that's not something that Republican politicians want to see going on long term.
I do want to shift gears. So let me just put a question from John. I'll put this to you, Molly. He says Republicans want a wall, Democrats don't. Is anyone talking about alternatives? What do you see as you look into your crystal ball? I mean, this can't go on forever. Someone's got to blink, it seems.
Right. I mean, I think now I've thought for a little while now that what gets us out of the current shutdown is some sort of deal that allows both all sides to save some face. And so whether that's additional money for border security that can't actually be used to build a new concrete structure at the border or something like that, I think that's probably eventually where we're going. But exactly the contours of what that deal looks like, how much money is involved, and when we get there will, I think, really depend again on whether President Trump can settle on a negotiating position and
stick to it.
Exactly.
Let me just put this out there, and Jonathan gave you a chance to respond to that, but I just feel like it must be said that on the majority of undocumented people in America, in the United States, are people who overstay their visas, not people that are trying to climb across a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Exactly right. And, you know, one of the things is that even the people, most people who really are anti-immigration, they don't particularly want this wall. You know, there's not a whole lot of evidence that anybody outside of Donald Trump really, really wants the wall, per se. So, you know, again, that's something that could be negotiated if Trump can figure out exactly where he stands.
Let me shift gears and talk a little bit about the 116th. Can we say, Molly Reynolds, that Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker of the House?
I think so. I mean, the formal vote will be tomorrow, midday. But I think everyone expects that she now has sufficient support to get reelected as Speaker, to return to the position that she had when Democrats were in the majority between 2007 and 2010. So I do think that's what we'll see happen tomorrow.
What do you see as her skills, Jonathan?
Well, she was a very good speaker. She's good at bringing people together. She's good at negotiations. She's good at sort of knowing her caucus and knowing exactly what they need to get to some sort of, you know, knowing individual members and what they need to get to yes on something that's the party agenda. So, you know, she's been a very skilled congressional leader. The Democrats are impatient with leadership that's been there for a very long time, and they're looking to change. You know, long term they want change, or medium term they want change. But I think they're going to be pretty satisfied with her and with the leadership team for this Congress.
And we're talking about people largely in their 70s, maybe even in their 80s, Jonathan?
In their 70s.
In their 70s.
Yeah, and that's, you know, as far as the formal party leadership, the Speaker, the incoming majority leader and majority whip. And that's unusual,
right?
That they're that old and they've been there that long.
Molly, there is this, obviously, this new crop of Democrats coming into the House, I think about 40 seats. They are, as I understand it, more progressive, more liberal. They're more women. They're more racially, ethnically, religiously diverse. What do you see happening in the House with this configuration of representatives?
Right. So we are going to see a relatively large new House freshman class, and it does include The House will include a record number of women as of tomorrow. And there are important advances that we're seeing in terms of racial and ethnic diversity as well. I mean, I think one of the challenges that will confront Pelosi as Speaker, but one she has some experience with, is figuring out how to manage a caucus that has a range of diverse perspectives in it. I mean, she will have these newer progressive members, but importantly, there are also some House freshmen who are from seats that flipped from Republicans that tend to be more moderate. So, you know, there's a freshman representative from Virginia named Abigail Spanberger, who beat Dave Brat, who's a very conservative member of the House Freedom Caucus. And so figuring out how to balance the need to get some of these more moderate members reelected, as well as the demands from the progressive wing of the party, will be a challenge for Pelosi. But it's not an unfamiliar challenge. You know, she spent 4 years as Speaker in the mid to late 2000s. And one of the things that she did effectively in those first 2 years as Speaker was spend some time, having the Democrats spend some time working out some intra-party disputes over certain policy questions, so that when they found themselves in unified party control at the beginning of 2009, after President Obama's election, they could really hit the ground running. I'm thinking here especially about health care.
Sure.
They spent those first 2 years when President Bush was still in the White House just doing some of the hard policy work and figuring out where is the party, what could the party actually pass when the conditions are ripe for more aggressive action.
Well, Jonathan, there will not be more Benghazi hearings, but there will be hearings, it seems, on the Trump administration, the Trump organization. I'm not sure, you know, how far afield that will go, but what do you anticipate?
Well, that's one of the big questions about the Democrats coming in. Are they going to emulate the way that Republicans sort of, you know, use oversight mainly to score political points, or are they going to use oversight the way it's intended to be used, more or less, which is to actually get the government working properly? Now, there's still plenty to be done, and plenty of it will have presumably political, you know, it's good politically for the Democrats to hold hearings on Trump or on malfeasance in some of these, you know, departments that have not had any oversight for the last 2 years. But we hope, at least, you know, one would hope that they won't be chasing down, you know, conspiracy rabbit holes, but they'll actually try to stick to facts and building fact records and, you know, doing oversight for a purpose.
What's a rabbit hole to you?
Oh, you know, there's plenty of stuff out there. but you know.
Is impeachment one of them or not?
Well, I think that that's going to be a very difficult question for the Democrats, because there is a lot, you know, it appears that the president has abused his power. The president has obstructed justice. There is sort of a minimal basis there for a legitimate impeachment. At the same time, right now, it would be a very partisan impeachment. It would go nowhere in the Senate. And I think that Democratic leaders, at least, recognize that there's no real point to doing it at this point, you know, as of what we know now. But as the investigations continue, they may get to the point where they feel real pressured by the facts of the situation to move forward. And that's going to be very difficult for them to figure out how to handle it.
Here's an email from Gary. He says, I hold a weak-kneed Congress partly responsible for this border wall shutdown mess. He goes on to say, frankly, if members of both parties could come together on this issue, we wouldn't be in this pickle. Do you agree with that, Molly?
So I think what's really important to remember about where we are with the shutdown is that the vast majority of the government, of kind of what the work that remains undone to keep parts of the federal government open through the end of the fiscal year, so through the end of September, would get large bipartisan majorities to vote for it in Congress. So, you know, funding for the State Department and the Commerce Department and the Department of Transportation and the departments that are unfunded. There's a lot of bipartisan agreement here, and the process in the Senate, especially, that generated the broad outlines of the funding bills that Congress hasn't finished work on, was very bipartisan last year. They've received bipartisan majorities in the Senate Appropriations Committee. There were lots of controversial policy items that were left out of those bills because they didn't want to sink them on a over kind of partisan fights. And so there's a lot of broad bipartisan agreement, and it really is just about this fight over the wall specifically and what the wall means and the symbolism and the, you know, Trump's base politics and all that kind of thing. That's really what's kind of gotten us stuck. It's much less about the broader dynamics in Congress on these spending bills in particular.
That's Molly Reynolds, who joins us along with Jonathan Bernstein. We are talking about the upcoming 116th Congress, gets underway tomorrow, and already there's much to talk about. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Richard says, isn't it appropriate to call the border wall a manufactured immigration crisis served up for a racist Republican base? I don't feel entirely comfortable with that, Richard, because I think it's a very broad stroke, and I think this is a very complicated issue that has many, many kinds of players. But, Jonathan, anything you want to say in response to Richard?
Well, I think that there's generally a sense that the wall, per se, is a symbolic issue. It's not really about the substance of it, about, you know, regulating the border, in other words. It's about symbolism and, you know, comes out of a Donald Trump campaign that played on bigotry and appealed to bigotry. So I don't have a real problem with saying that about the wall, about the, you know, the wall as an issue, as opposed to more general questions about border security, which are sort of legitimate questions that the parties go back and forth on.
Let me get Jake from Camden County to join us on Radio Times, and then I do want to move on, actually talk about an op-ed that Mitt Romney had in the Washington Post. Jake, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to guess to discuss an aspect that I don't hear too much concerning the immigration issue, and that is that something I understood 25 years ago, that it was a Republican initiative that introduced a lot of cheap foreign labor into the country from south of the border. They set up networks in order to move them through the country as a union busting tactic. This was like open discussion 25, 30 years ago, and I haven't heard it talked about too much.
Well, Jake,
I'd like the guests to maybe shed some light.
Sure, and I should say that our guests are not experts in immigration, but it's something that they certainly have looked at. Molly, anything you want to say in response to Jake?
So I will say that generally, you know, we've seen changes over the past 30 to 40 years in U.S. immigration policy that have led more folks trying to cross the southern border who are, you know, family units, so more women and children as opposed to just sort of men crossing as single individuals trying to come here to seek work. We've seen many more women and children try to cross the border as well. And that's had, I think, some pretty profound consequences for how we talk about the crisis at the southern border. It certainly had consequences when we were facing the family separation crisis last summer. And so over time, we've definitely seen these changes. And as Congress has generally struggled more to legislate productively, one of the consequences has been the Congress has really struggled to enact any kind of comprehensive immigration reform that could respond to these changing dynamics in the immigration environment.
Jake, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jonathan, let me just quote something from Mitt Romney's op-ed in the Washington Post, where he really calls into question the character of the president. He says, to a great degree, a president's shapes the public character of the nation. A president should unite us and inspire us to follow our better angels. A president should demonstrate the essential qualities of honesty and integrity and elevate the national discourse with comedy and mutual respect. He goes on to say it is in this province where the incumbent's shortfall has been most glaring, referring to President Trump. We've got former governor, former presidential candidate, and now Senator Mitt Romney Romney in the U.S. Senate. What do you anticipate here?
Well, at the very least, he's signaling that he's going to sort of take Jeff Flake and John McCain's place, you know, in the Senate as someone who calls out Trump whenever Trump sort of misbehaves so egregiously that you know, everybody thinks that he should be called out on it. And of course, many Republicans have not done so. Whether there'll be more to it or not, well, we'll have to see. You know, one of the questions is going to be when we have Robert Mueller's report, when we have further indictments, if we do coming down, exactly what Republicans are going to do about it. And, you know, Romney, I guess, coming in is saying, well, he's going to be a player in that game.
Yeah. Molly, what do you see?
Yeah, I would largely agree with Jonathan, is that I think that we should expect Mitt Romney to, by and large, be just an extremely conservative Republican senator. That's kind of where his policy positions are. You know, I expect, particularly after this border funding, this government funding crisis, the shutdown with this dispute over the border is resolved, that much of what the Senate will spend the rest of the next 2 years doing is trying to confirm additional federal judges. And there's nothing that leads me to think that Mitt Romney won't be a reliable vote for Mitch McConnell in that endeavor. But it is noteworthy that a freshman Republican senator came out with these anti-Trump statements before he is sworn in. So we'll just, like Jonathan said, we'll just have to see whether it translates into much more than kind of the furrowed brows and occasional condemnations that we've seen from a few other Republican senators so far.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Molly Reynolds. She's a fellow in governance studies at Brookings, and she studies Congress, how congressional rules and procedure affect domestic policy outcomes. Jonathan Bernstein, Bloomberg opinion columnist, and he covers politics and policy. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, politics and policy. The president, the upcoming 116th Congress, Mitt Romney, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org and at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Molly Reynolds and Jonathan Bernstein. Jonathan, you mentioned Robert Mueller, the special counsel. The investigation continues. Do you think he needs protection from being fired by President Trump?
Well, I think what we've seen last year is that Republicans have, to their credit, made statements that it's important to keep him on. What they haven't done is they haven't been willing to pass legislation to protect him. Democrats are going to do that out of the House, and it'll fall to the Senate to probably ignore it. The question is, will Democrats then tack on a Mueller protection rider to some must-pass legislation? And then they'll have a more difficult decision. In the previous Congress, there seemed to be a pretty solid majority for passing a Mueller protection measure in the Senate if it had reached the floor, but Mitch McConnell didn't bring it there. It's not as clear whether there's a simple majority of votes to do that in the new Senate with a slightly different constellation of senators.
Well, Molly, we could spend hours on end talking about how the Senate rules work, but just it seems as if the majority leader, I guess whoever it is, really does calls the shots in the Senate.
Generally, that's the case, that the majority leader gets to decide what comes to the floor, what does not come to the floor. There are some individual tools that individual senators can try to use to influence that process. And we've seen the current crop of senators be more or less likely to try and force the majority leader's hand on certain pieces of legislation. You know, we saw, for example, at the end of December, now retiring Senator Jeff Flake say that he wouldn't vote for any judicial nominees unless the Senate voted on a bill to protect Robert Mueller. So occasionally we do see some senators use their individual leverage to try to influence what the Senate Majority Leader does. But at the end of the day, by and large, Mitch McConnell is the one who gets to decide what the Senate votes on. He makes those choices in accordance with what he thinks is best for his ability to maintain a majority in the Senate in the next election.
So what's good for him?
Well, not just what's good for him, but really what's good for the Senate Republican Party and what is most likely to get to ensure that after the next election, there are still 51 Republican senators in the Senate.
So infrastructure, drug pricing, I mean, climate change. I'm thinking of all the important issues, policies or potential policies facing the country. Do you think Molly will get any of that stuff?
So I think it's relatively unlikely. I mean, two of the three issues that you mentioned are two issues that I could maybe see some action on, and those are infrastructure and prescription drug pricing. Right. So, on infrastructure, it's really tricky because everyone says they're for a big infrastructure bill, but when we talk about that, different people mean different things. And, you know, some Democrats have come out saying that any infrastructure bill must also address climate change, which I would expect would be a non-starter among many Republicans. On drug pricing, obviously addressing prescription drug prices is broadly popular, and it's something on which the Trump administration actually has been quite active in the latter half of 2018. So we could see some action there, but the kind of basic dynamics of divided control in Congress and a Republican president in the White House aren't suggestive to me that we'll see a lot of legislative action in 2019 and 2020.
What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, I think that there is some possibility, but there's sort of two variables that we don't know yet. One is on the Democratic side, do House Democrats, is their main priority to get as much legislative gain as they can, policy gain as they can, pass things that are as good for Democrats as possible? Or is their main priority going to be, as it was for Republicans when Barack Obama was president, to prevent Trump from having any victories? And it's not clear which way Pelosi and the other Democrats are going to feel about that. The other side of it is, can the president and the White House manage to be coherent for 30 seconds at a time? You know, they're in the middle of a shutdown that's basically irrational. It didn't make any sense the way that they got into it, the way they're doing it. There could be common ground on drug pricing, on infrastructure, perhaps on other issues as well, that they could make trade-offs. You know, maybe, on DACA for something that Trump wants, or a minimum wage increase for something that Republicans want. But it takes a negotiating partner that can negotiate coherently, and that's been missing so far.
The art of the deal, are you referring to?
Yeah, well, that's what Trump is supposed to have had. But, you know, in reality, he's just made it very difficult to cut any deals. Democrats or Republicans.
Jonathan, from your perspective, does our president know how government works?
No.
And I'm nodding quietly on the radio as you're talking there. So let me go back to you, Molly. So if what Congress decides is what's good for each party, is that because we are in the perpetual campaign where someone is always campaigning for either election or reelection?
I mean, the electoral dynamics really do influence so much of what Congress does. And if you look back over kind of the period since 1980, we've been living in an era where competition for control of Congress is pretty competitive. So there's a political scientist named Frances Lee who's written a great book about this, where she argues that because each party can look at the next election and see themselves themselves potentially winning a majority, that really affects the incentives that they have to cooperate across the aisle. Why would you give the other party any kind of policy victories if it means that it makes it easier for them to get reelected into the majority, whereas you've remained in the minority? And that kind of macro-level political competition has really, I think, affected what how willing members of Congress are to work across the aisle with one another.
Do you think there's something new about that, Jonathan?
You know, in the sort of earlier era where Democrats had control of the House and Senate for a couple decades, you know, from the 1930s through 1980, except for a couple Congresses, power used to be less concentrated in the party leadership, and it was more devolved to committees, which were more bipartisan in nature, and the parties themselves were less ideologically coherent. So there were, the Democrats were famously very incoherent. They had extremely conservative Dixiecrats, and they had liberals. But the Republicans had a range of moderates and even liberals, as well as conservatives and arch-conservatives, and all of that's gone away. You know, the most conservative Democrat is much more liberal than the most liberal Republican in both the House and the Senate, and that's been true for about 20 years or so. And it does make compromise more difficult. I think Francis Lee's work is very appropriate to cite here, but I also think that there is some choice, and there have been times when, during divided government, when the party out of the White House has made decisions to cut deals and get policy gains, even though it gave a president a chance for a Rose Garden ceremony. So, yeah, there's some choice, even though the incentives are exactly what Molly is saying.
When's the last time that happened?
A bipartisan deal?
Yeah.
We just had, you know, it was a Republican Congress, but we just had a criminal justice bill that was very bipartisan. So it happens, and it happens on sort of secondary level things all the time in every Congress. You know, we focus on the big, you know, top campaign issues, the Mexico wall or whatever, you know, Obamacare. But lower down, there usually is some level of bipartisanship on some issues that actually does happen.
Well, let me go back to you and talk a bit about what budget battles. I mean, I guess we have things called continuing resolutions, and there's the debt limit on the horizon. All of these are obviously in play as Congress tries to figure out how to pay for programs. What do you anticipate?
Right. So one of the reasons why it's really important to talk about major budgetary legislation is because that generally it's seen as must pass. It's seen as things that Congress has to do. And if it doesn't, then we end up with a partial government shutdown like the one that we're experiencing right now. But a couple big things to watch in 2019. One is the debt limit. The projections suggest that the Treasury Department will exhaust all of its extraordinary measures for keeping us under the current debt limit sometime this summer or fall. So at some point this year, Congress will need to act on that. The other big thing to watch is that Congress has, so in 2011, Congress adopted a set of discretionary spending caps, limiting the overall amount of spending both on defense programs and non-defense programs. Every 2 years since then, Congress has taken a look at those limits and said, oh, they're too restrictive. We don't actually want to follow them. Let's come to a deal to raise those limits a little bit. The current deal on those spending caps expires at the end of September. So Congress will need to come to agreement on those as well, or federal agencies will be facing really significant cuts starting in the new fiscal year that begins October 1. And so those will be two really important dynamics to watch. Those are things that Congress really has to do, regardless of whatever other partisan turmoil is going on. And if they don't, the consequences are quite high.
And the tax cuts, did that add to the deficit?
It did. Republicans spent much of the end of 2018 talking about doing more tax cuts. I mean, I would expect those. That's kind of off the table now with the coming Democratic majority in the House. I expect that we'll still hear Democrats in Congress talk a lot about the consequences of the 2017 tax bill, in large part because it turned out to be very unpopular. One of my Brookings colleagues, Vanessa Williamson, has some great work on the degree to which Republicans really did not pursue the tax bill and its messaging around it in the 2018 campaign because it was really unpopular with voters. Mm-hmm. And so I expect that Democrats in Congress will try to highlight that and talk about the degree to which Republicans chose to write this tax bill that benefited wealthy Americans and corporations over middle class ones over the next 2 years.
And Jonathan, there's a number of vacancies. Mulvaney is acting chief of staff in the White House. Justice Attorney General, that's an opening. Zinke left the Interior. Mattis left, I guess yesterday was his kind of final day on job as Secretary of Defense. What do you make of all these people leaving the Trump White House or Trump administration?
Well, I think that the White House is in disarray, and people, in one sense, people don't want to be there. In another sense, it's very easy to get to Trump and manipulate him into wanting to fire somebody. One thing Trump has going for him is, he was able to get everybody pretty much that he wanted confirmed by the Senate last time, but it's a lot easier with 53 senators, Republican senators, than it was with 51. He shouldn't have really any difficulties getting people confirmed as long as he nominates sort of mainstream people, mainstream Republican people, that is, unless he gets quite a bit less popular than he is now.
Well, Kelly talked about, being chief of staff as a bone-crushing job.
It can't be much fun to work there.
Yeah.
The president changes his mind every day. He doesn't seem to know sort of the basic. He doesn't seem to have a sense of what the job is or what the United States government does. And he is hostile to learning. And, he's somebody who is not young, has been successful, at least as he sees it, through life. And then on top of that, he went and got elected president of the United States when everybody said it would never happen. So it's hard to talk sense into somebody in that situation if they don't want to listen.
Just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye. I wasn't going to actually raise this because I don't like to talk about the upcoming presidential campaign, but it seems it has already begun with a couple of people at least setting up exploratory committees, Senator Elizabeth Warren being the most recent one. Molly, should we buckle our seatbelts and get ready for the presidential election?
I mean, I think if anyone hasn't buckled their seatbelt and gotten ready already, they are in danger of being ejected from their car as we begin here. I mean, I think it's clear and has been clear for a while that there are, upwards of 20 to 30 Democrats who are seriously considering pursuing the Democratic nomination in 2020. That includes, to return to our topic of conversation this hour, a number of members of the Senate, of the House, including some recently departed House members like Beto O'Rourke from Jonathan's home state of Texas. And so I think that, we're already down this road, I think one thing to watch in Congress, particularly over the next year, is are there ways that some of these folks who are currently serving in Congress, who are interested in pursuing the nomination, try to use Congress, the Senate in particular, as a platform to help them start those presidential campaigns?
Jonathan, I'm giving you the last word. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. If we have 5, 6, 7 Democratic senators running for president, they're going, that's a significant portion of the Democratic Party, and they're more or less very similar in policy positions, so they're going to look for ways to differentiate themselves, and that plays out in how the Senate actually functions.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Jonathan Bernstein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Bloomberg Opinion columnist. Also with us, Molly Reynolds. Molly, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And she's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for our Facebook listeners group. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.